What's good? What's good? One and only Paul Masson, live from Vietnam. Another live from Vietnam Friday. Normally, I go live at 7 p.m. Eastern time. But supposed to have a special guest coming on live from the Czech Republic. And I want to give him a little bit of time. He might have lost track of time and whatnot because he is 6 hours ahead of us and whatnot. I did an interview last night, pre-recorded, with Nine. So if y'all don't know who Nine is, Nine was an artist with a gritty voice in hip-hop that dropped the album called Nine Lives back in the days around like 94. And he dropped another album after that called Cloud Nine. And then he's got a couple other albums under his belt as well. One called King, produced by the Snow Goons. And very interesting interview. Go check that out. You know, it's on Facebook. It's on Instagram. It's on YouTube, BitChute, Spotify, Apple, Amazon, Deezer, TuneIn, Stitcher, Slacker, iHeartRadio, Player FM, and much, much more. I just booked an interview with Mad from the Goats. Excuse me about the burp here. If y'all don't know the Goats, go check out the Goats. They had an album called, what was it? Something Shades, but they had a single called Not Your Typical American. So definitely go check that out. What other interviews I did recently? I did Big Kaz interview last week as well. Go check that out. And we did an interview with Hakeem Green, part two. We got into some conspiracy theories. You know what's crazy is YouTube. So we got the audio version and the video version of the podcast. So the audio version, you know, upload the audio, boom, and then it goes to Spotify, you know, Apple, Amazon, Deezer, TuneIn, Stitcher, Slacker, iHeartRadio, and all that good stuff. So the audio version, apparently YouTube censored it and pulled it off, talking about medical misinformation. Because I basically just stated a conspiracy theory, but we didn't really get into the conspiracy theory. So it's crazy that they would say medical misinformation. Also, go check out the interview with Sadat X, Phantasm and the Cellar Dwellers, Chili Too Cold, Young Bleed, and Cool Kim of the UMCs. I mean, it's a pretty good year to start off, I would say. I would definitely say it's been a really, really good year of interviews so far, and we're going to keep them going. Let me see what's up. You know, sometimes things happen. I don't like to make any assumptions about people not showing up for interviews unless I don't hear from them. If I don't hear from them ever again, then you can make assumptions. But, you know, sometimes things happen. People get family emergencies, getting car wrecks or whatever. I want to talk about something that Nine brought up where he was saying there's only been, you know, because I asked him about the Drake and the Kendrick battle, and he said, I asked him, did it go the way he thought it would? He said, nah, because he didn't think somebody would get, you know, murdered or killed, basically talking about their career. And I guess he was talking about Drake. So then we were talking about the biggest the rap battle. He said it was 4 rap battles where careers got killed. So we was going through them. And, you know, one of them was Karis won and MC Shan. He said, of course, the Ja Rule and 50 Cent. And then what was the other one? So he said, oh yeah, the Ice Cube and NWA. You know, so I was just trying to go through some of these other rap battles. And was there any I saw that where somebody's career got killed? I mean, Eazy-E, Dr. Dre. I mean, Eazy-E was still popping after that. And he literally brought out Bone. Cool Mo D and Busy B. I'm too young to know about that one. Boogie Down Productions versus Juice Crew. I wouldn't say they killed the career. Common versus West Side Connection. I don't know, man. I want to say maybe the other guy's careers, maybe Mac 10 and Dub C, but he definitely didn't kill Ice Cube's career. Cool Moe D and LL. I don't know how big Cool Moe D was after, was how big he was after the LL Cool J battle. Cannabis and LL. I mean, Cannabis had a long career, man, but his career never really amounted to, I think, what people might have expected, being so dope of a lyricist with his punchlines and metaphors. And I mean, he had a good career, but I guess you could say the career didn't amount to what it should have been because of maybe the LL and Cannabis beef. Ice Cube and NWA. I mean, NWA was never the same after the Ice Cube beef. Tupac versus Biggie. I mean, this one didn't kill no careers, but it literally got two people killed. Well, actually, I would say Pac got himself killed by his actions. And then Biggie got killed because his beef with Pac, or so-called beef with Pac, that after Pac died, it kind of, you know, it was just like a trickle-down effect, cause and effect. Pac got killed, so people kind of were running wild with conspiracies. They always, you know, they still to this day, people saying allegedly Puffy had something to do with it. I've heard allegedly Suge had something to do with it. Why would Suge have something to do with it when he was in a car and he took a bullet too? Jay-Z and Nas, that didn't kill no careers. That didn't kill no careers. If anything, that propelled Nas back up, and Jay-Z still mounted to what he was amounted to. I haven't heard back from our guest yet. So I'm going to go over some. I want to talk about this Texas rapper, G Money Little Ronnie. His 5-year-old daughter killed in a shooting at a car wash. Let me look at the camera when I say this. This is the part of hip hop that I really dislike about hip hop. This element that seems to be glorified and embraced all throughout the culture. Not everybody does, because like Hakeem Green, I had him on here recently. He's definitely not with none of that stuff, you know. But this is the part of the culture that just, I think, turns a lot of people away from hip hop culture, especially nowadays. Maybe not so much in the 90s, because it was so much. We talk about diversity. The 90s definitely had diversity. You had your gangster rappers, you had your thug rappers, you had your sexual rappers, you had your drug boy rappers, you had your clubby rappers, your commercial mainstream rappers, you had your backpack rappers, your lyrical rappers, punchline rappers, you had whatever, you know what I'm saying? Conscious rappers, you had every kind of rap style you could think of, every type of rapper that you possibly wanted or needed in your life as a hip hop fan. Nowadays, we only got like one kind of rapper, man. We got one kind of rapper. And I saw a post that was saying, like, back in our era in the 90s, we made like drug dealer music, and now they make drug user music, which is really a big shift. You know what I'm saying? And then nowadays, I would argue that these cats nowadays, when they get deals, they like to stay in the streets more. They like to stay close to that element a lot more. It's like, you know, I always thought making it as a musician was like to get you out of all those bad elements that might be in your life, or to bring some financial success or stability or some comfort. The fact that people get all this money and they still attach themselves to the street life, to people that are attached to the street. Like, that's the thing. You got to detach yourself not only from the streets, you got to attach yourself or detach yourself from the people that are attached to the streets as well. Because if you attach to any one person that's still attached to the streets, then so are you. And it really sucks, man, that I really feel sorry for the 5-year-old more than anything. Innocent life, hasn't even had a chance to live a life, all because I don't got to listen to the music of G Money Lil Ronnie to know that he was definitely attached to those elements. He was probably either, you know, flashing jewelry and money everywhere he goes, or he was possibly gang banging. And that's the thing. People think you could get out once you start gang banging. There's no getting out. It can always come back to haunt you. I mean, you could stop gang banging, but you're never truly out. Your hands are never washed clean, you know. You still got dirt on your hands as soon as you become a gangbanger, as soon as you become a gangster and live that lifestyle. And I'm talking about like joining an actual gang, you know what I'm saying? Bloods, Crips, whatever these gangs be, you get jumped in, beat in, or sometimes they got to kill people to get in, you know what I'm saying? There's no getting out of that. They tell you once you get into those things, there's no getting out. And just because you move to another state and you stop gangbanging, who's to say that somebody from your past doesn't run into you in that state and it doesn't catch up with you? That could happen easily. Wrong place, wrong time, you know? So yeah, when you bring a certain element in your life, you bring it into your family's life too. You could, because anybody that's around you, if there's people that's willing to kill you over whatever it may be, some old beefs, or they trying to, it doesn't seem like a robbery. I didn't hear nothing about them robbing him for his jewels or anything. So it seems like an old beef. So if there's people willing to kill you over an old beef, anybody that you got around you, life could be in danger, could be in jeopardy. You talk about guilty by association. I mean, that's the worst form of guilty by association, when you could literally get killed just for being around somebody that people want to kill for whatever reason it may be. You know, but this is the part of hip hop that definitely would drive people away, that keep them far away from hip hop culture. It definitely reflects the culture super heavily. Cause when you think about it, besides Kendrick and Cole, all the like conscious rappers or positive rappers, or most of them cats are like underground. They're mostly not mainstream. I mean, there's only two mainstream rappers that you could call positive or conscious rappers, and that would probably be Kendrick and Cole. That's it. I can't think of nobody else in the mainstream that you would call a conscious or positive rapper. You never hear Cole pushing negativity. You never really hear Kendrick pushing negativity. But it's not enough abundance of it in the mainstream. And that's why pretty much the culture is reflected by one sound, one type of artist, the shoot 'em up, bang, bang, I fuck bitches, I use drugs. No kind of respect for anybody in society or themselves. That's what the sound really reflects nowadays. If you want to find something, you know, that doesn't reflect that, you got to go digging in the crates, man. You got to go digging in the underground. And even when you go digging in the underground, there's a lot of gangster rappers, thug rappers, shoot 'em up, bang bang, dope boy rappers, you know. So, yeah, man, it's sad that the 5-year-old got killed just because she was around her father, who definitely probably shouldn't have had his kid around him, because he definitely, like, I saw the video where his mom said he was such a good kid. He never did nothing to nobody. Nobody just drives up on you and kills you at a car wash because you ain't never did nothing to nobody, man. You can't tell me that lie, man. You can't look at me with a straight face and tell me that lie. You can't do it. You know what? Let's call Afu and see what's up. I'm going to call our guest real quick and see if we... Sometimes we've had cats come late on the interviews and whatnot. Hello? What up, man? Yeah, I can hear you a little bit. I was just trying to see if you still going to be able to do the interview. Actually, like 20 minutes ago, man, but yeah. Okay, I mean, I'm on the live right now, so whenever you get, you know, you got a chance, just click the link and, you know, we'll get right into it. All right, preach. All right, so that was just our guest. Give him a few minutes to come up. Like I said, man, cats lose track of time and whatnot. But, yeah, man. I mean, I don't wish death on nobody. Rest in peace to G-Money Lil Ronnie. Definitely rest in peace to his five-year-old daughter. But I just think, like, this is the part of hip-hop that really sucks. That, you know, like, the five-year-old is basically dead because of, you know, just a lifestyle or element that her father had in his life that he apparently couldn't let go, or a past that just caught up with him. And that's the thing. Like, when you do dirt to people, it can catch up with you at any time, at any moment, you know, in your life. You never know. I know guys that used to, like, do armed robberies back in the days and go to the club and get caught slipping and get shanked at the club. You know, so... All right, so a guest just popped in right now, and for all you real hip-hop heads, you definitely gonna know this guy. I first heard him on The Sun Rises in the East on J. Rue the Damage's album, Mental Stamina. He was also on the Wrath of the Math album for J. Rue the Damage, Physical Stamina. Y'all might know him from his solo career as well, where he's got like 4 albums under his belt. Body of the Life Force, Life Force Radio, State of the Arts, and Body of the Life Force 2. Let's bring on the one and only Afu Ra.
Yo, peace, Body of the Life Force in the house. Thank you for having me. Yeah, much respect. How you doing?
I'm doing good. Let's give you a little...
Yeah, much respect. Shout out. Yeah, thank you for the applause, and thank you for the warm welcome. It's a pleasure.
So you out in the Czech Republic now, right?
Yeah, that's right. I'm in the Czech Republic right now. I stay out here. I do bounce back and forth between BK and out here, but I got okay. two young sons out here. So okay. I spend most of my time out here nowadays.
That's what's up. Afu Ra, is part of that name like from the Egyptian sun god, Ra?
Yeah, Afu Ra was a character in a book called The Egyptian Book of the Dead. Okay. And that book touches on different aspects of Egyptology, but at the time when I basically was looking for something, searching for something, but I didn't know it. That name jumped out at me through the book, and I kind of adapted it as my name and started, you know, just having something to represent me in terms of a name, Afu Ra. And then luckily, excuse me, the whole hip hop thing just happened. It was kind of in the works, but then when I got my platform to release my album, you know, I was already off riding the streets amongst the Gangsta Foundation, amongst my fam, amongst people that know me. So the whole transition and me taking on the name Afura as a sort of the spiritual awakening or just something to live by in the name, that's how it all happened.
Now, since you grew up with J. Rue in Brooklyn, and how long did you know him before you appeared on his album?
Well, myself and J. Rue, we grew up in East New York, Brooklyn. So J. Rue, I believe, is 2 years older than me. So okay. It had to be, I'm going to say, I remember it from being in the sixth grade or seventh grade.
Wow.
Hannibal Stacks also was in my junior high school class.
Hannibal Stacks too?
Yeah. It's kind of crazy. I was speaking about the synchronicity. My synchronicity a while back on one of my social channels, myself, J. Rue the Damager, Hannibal Stacks, Master Killer, Blase, P.F. Cutton. We all kind of from that same little nook in East New York, Brooklyn. So however you could translate it, we all was around a certain type of energy. King Shabazz or True Master, who went on to produce many of the great Wu-Tangs, also kind of linked me to Wu-Tang. And although Master Killer was from the neighborhood, True Master was the one who exposed me and the rest of us, like J. Rue the Damager, Hannibal Stacks, and other brothers, to Wu-Tang and what RZA and them had going on. So, you know, dial it back. Yeah, myself and J. Rue, we grew up since I was in high school. I'm 50 now, so I'm going to say that had to be like early 80s, so like 81. Wow. I was in junior high school in East New York. I lived
I
in East
New York. Years old.
Yeah, J. Rue the Damager was like over on Pickin and Pennsylvania. And I grew up on top of Miller Hill, like Jamaica and Van Sicklin. So from that football game, that one day we had the football game, rough tackle in the park. And I was like, yeah, me and my block, we got a football team at high school. And Hannibal Stack was like, what you talking about, football? Me and my crew got the football. He was from Warwick. So it was like, all right. So I was like, all right, let's get it on. So the next weekend, we was out in the park, Highland Park. We had our rough tackle game, and then we kind of merged teams at that point.
Now, how did the opportunity come about when you got on his album?
Well, from that point on, from the football game, you know, just being in East New York, you know, we kind of crewed up without crewing up. You know, we kind of crewed up without crewing up. And I mean by myself, J. Rue the Damager, Hannibal Stacks, his people, his cousins and uncles, also other brothers on the block. Blase was part of that. We kind of had like this little network of dudes that was just around. But specifically myself, J. Rue, my older brother and True Master, we kind of maybe had like a side little crew or group, just the people who really hung out up where I lived on Highland Boulevard, Miller and Highland Boulevard in East New York, Brooklyn. And we kind of was like a little bit away from where Hannibal Stacks and them was. So just through the camaraderie of being together, J. Rue actually at that time, I'm going to say, yeah. So I'm going to say at that time of 84-ish, 80. 85-ish before or right around the time I was going to high school, J. Rue was the one like, yo, like, I'ma be a big rap star, yo. A fool. I'ma be on MTV and all of the la la la's. And I was his man, so it was like, no doubt, you know, he would be, yo, check this rhyme out, check this, yo, a fool. Come to my crib, he would call me, I'd call him, yo, a fool, come to my crib, come, I want you to come check this rhyme. I wrote this new rhyme. I'm on the way. So I would be there for him. And I was his man. And we was rhyming together in the hood. We're just rhyming together in the neighborhood. Myself, J. Rue the Damager, True Master. True Master at the time also was one of the nicest MCs like ever before Ja Rule was nice and before like I knew even who if dudes was nice rhyming. True Master at the time he was King Shabazz was one of the nicest MCs like on the level of a Rakim, even oh, in his own right. So, but he kind of shifted and drifted away from rap. Or MC, and then Ja Rule was also, Ja Rule just kept his nose to the ground, so kept writing. We kept freestyling. We used to, you know, practice Kung Fu in the hood, or we used to play chess. That's when the Master Killers and the Jizzers through True Master started networking with us in East New York. So when Ja Rule got his opportunity, it was a little bit after that. One of the older guards in the hood was doing security in the New York club scene. And when Guru came from Boston to kind of do his own networking, the older guard linked Ja Rule with Guru, like, because Guru was looking for, not to say Guru was looking for a crew, but Guru was definitely trying to percolate, or Guru was definitely trying to rub elbows with some New York dudes, because Guru was from Boston. So he's in BK, he's Gangstar. Gangstar hadn't really formed yet. I think it was like right in the on the cusp of Guru being joined with Premier, and then they whole Gangstar started happening. And it was like, yeah, they were looking for certain soldiers. They were looking for MCs to funnel through the Gangstar production. So Ja Rule just happened to be there. He was one of the nicest young rappers in the neighborhood. The older guard name was Vic Black. We had helped out Vic Black one day, or we was just there for him in some kind of way where he remembered that when he met Guru. It's like, oh, Ja Rule, link up with Guru. And then from there, it just all happened rather quickly. Within a year, Ja Rule was now from demoing his music with Guru to now, I guess Guru was like, well, Ja Rule was so heat rock. Let me get into Premier, because Guru was a producer, but not like Premier. So once Guru did that with Primo and Ja Rule, then Ja Rule had the blockbuster single right out the gate almost. And at that time, it was a lot real. It was maybe a little bit more grassroots oriented in New York City. So Ja Rule's on the radio. I was Ja Rule man. The album came rather quickly to Ja Rule, and it was like I was there every day from when we were just on the park bench thinking about, Rule was telling me, yo, I'm gonna be on MTV, watch it. I'm gonna be a big rap star, watch, we're gonna go around the world and yada yada yada. And I was like, yeah, no doubt. Just I'm not gonna say playing it off, but just supporting my homie. Maybe I might have been in a bit of a euphoric space. I was young. I was like, that's my homie for sure. Yeah, you're going to be a big rap star. And yeah, the rhyme is dope. And spit it again. So when it came time for Ja Rule to do the album, we never discussed it. But Ja Rule had in his mind how he was going to do the album. He was like, yo, Primo, wait till you hear I Fool. He crazy. And I never even rhymed one rap for Primo. I never rhymed one verse for Primo, except for the verses on Ja Rule's album. And through that relationship, I was there. I went on the tours with Gangstar and Ja Rule. And that's how my whole thing, you know, earthed and became part of the Gangstar Foundation from Ja Rule's album. And I guess I got on the Ja Rule album because I was his homie. Yeah. I was supporting him. We was there. It was just like, we was just homie. We was click from East New York.
Now, in between like the first Ja Rule album and the second with the features, what was your process at that time? Were you trying to get a solo deal, or were you just kind of like waiting your turn?
Exactly. Actually, I don't even know what my process was. Maybe like when I look back at that time now, from where I am now, I envy the Lil Waynes and the Cash Moneys, and I envy like how the Southern artists were like really like doing the artist development and really thinking business wise and really using every step as a platform to like you know to emerge as artists and from everything from the merchandise to the music to getting those bigger deals. At the time, I didn't have a clue. I'm going to tell you the truth. Yeah, I was on J-Roo's album. We had the killer video. So I had my own little part of success with the J-Roo, with the Gangstar Foundation. We went on tour. So I was in like most countries in Europe and all of the states, every major city in the United States, all over Europe, all over Japan. So I kind of got caught in that euphoric bubble of being an artist, being with my homies. My homies is fly. My homies is slamming the mic. My homies is like J-Roo the Damager and Guru. And at that period, that was like a renaissance period of hip hop in coming from the East Coast. And my homies was killing the mic. You know what I mean? Yeah. Killing the mic. And I was just there like, okay, I got my little sprinkle of majesticness with J-Roo.
Yeah.
So I kind of was just going with the flow.
It's like you were just enjoying the moment.
Exactly. Just enjoying the moment, going with the flow, going on tour. I wasn't really thinking about a deal. That didn't come until after J-Roo's second album when thoughts of a deal started circling around. So that in-between moment was like enjoying the fun too much. I should have been more on my business, but I didn't have a guru. I didn't RIP guru, but I didn't have a guru in my ear that was, you know, mentoring me, which I needed at that time. But I didn't have one. I didn't know that I needed one. So I was just enjoying it, seeing the world, watching my brother's success. And it still also means a lot that I even can say that was going on and I was taken care of. And I experienced that period of the Gangstar Foundation come together and J-Roo's first album success. And it was incredible.
No, that was a beautiful time for hip hop. And your first album was on Koch. Did you have other label offers? And why did you go with Koch?
Thank you for the question. Nice one there. My first album was with Koch. It was kind of, I'm going to say, like a handoff deal. Originally I was signed with G Street. I think they were called G Street. If my memory serves correctly, G Street was like a distrib was like sorry was a was a was a sub label off of Geffen. If I'm not mistaken. But G Street, they had a lot of money, they had a lot of connections. But for some reason, like the touch with hip hop at that time, it was still kind of new. The branding and the marketing and the like way to like exploit a hip hop artist really hadn't taken off yet. At that time you had Gangstar, even Gangstar at that time. Their label still didn't know how to really like just catapult them through other business ventures, or if you want to say the cross marketing strategy, or basically the cross marketing strategy or branding. So all of that time, when I look at like what Puffy did or what Diddy did with the cross marketing and the branding and the co-branding of an artist like Biggie, or when I look at with Jay-Z and Rockefeller, how through the merchandising and the movies and the mixtape, the kind of collaborative marketing, what they did for Jay-Z and Biggie, I kind of look at, that's what we should have been doing. We didn't do it. So G Street was my home with D&D Records. And then for some reason, after the release of the first single, which was Whirlwind Through Cities, which was hugely successful, but again, at that time, 40,000 vinyl or 30,000 vinyl on a single, I didn't know what that meant.
Yeah.
I didn't know what that meant at that time. 33,000 copies sold on the vinyl, the Whirlwind Through Cities through Fat Beats. Although I knew I was one of those top tier artists in the underground scene, like the whole CMJ scene and the up and coming lyricists and MC, I knew that, but it wasn't translating. It wasn't translating into a financial picture or a picture that really would help me maybe navigate my business structure of my business etiquette in the music business. I definitely didn't know what was going on, and I now that we're here now, I definitely was taken advantage of, or definitely was, let's say, blinded, or kept my label kept the blinders on me that I would not understand the element of how much I was selling and how much money was out there due to that. So, but however successful the first single was, G Street decided to drop the project. G Street decided to, after helping fund the making of the album and helping fund the designing of the album cover and all of that, which was through my input, the album cover and the kind of tech and martial art aura and aesthetic. And then D&D jumped over the Koch. I'm not sure how it happened, but it did happen. It happened rather quickly. And we was off and running with Koch promoting the album worldwide. Got back on tours. Luckily that the touring just all just fell in my lap, and it continues to help me do my thing as a person and get around. And lots of people know that that's where artists make most of their bread at, is being on tour. So that's still happening. That's still going on. But from back in the days till now, the whole, like, let's say, business situation not being in my best interest, it still haunts me to today, and I still haven't got my foot out of the hole, if you could say, with the type of deal I signed back in the days. However fortunate I was, I'm still very fortunate, I can't say that, but I guess you know what I mean in terms of where labels could be getting the best out of the artist even after 20 years, still owning masters, things of that nature. Yeah, however grateful I am, I still feel that maybe things could be a bit different in terms of where my ownership is at and what rights I have and don't have to my original creations.
Now, you had a Wu-Tang member on your first three albums. You think you would have fit good as a Wu-Tang affiliate artist as well, too?
I think I would have also, because that style of, you know, the Kung Fu MC and the pugilistic lyricism, that was a chamber of MC, and that me and J. Rue, I'm not going to say only J. Rue, but we was there with the Kung Fu. We were into the Kung Fu movies, as many of our brothers and sisters were around the hood, around the U.S. So when Wu-Tang came, they had the name. They had the understanding, the knowledge of the Shaolin. And as well, we did also, because we watched the same flicks. We was into the same essences of Master Killer, Gordon Liu, or the many different martial arts superstars. Also that element of the superhuman in the Kung Fu geniuses that is portrayed in all of those films. So when Wu-Tang came out, we was like, whoa, oh man. And plus, they was an extension of our brothers. So hell yeah, had I been called upon by the Abbot, which I was there with the Abbot before there was the Wu-Tang, also GZA, before the whole Wu-Tang, let's say before the whole Wu-Tang envelope opened up, like into our underground mainstream, we were there together building, playing chess, fighting Kung Fu, freestyling, just being dudes, you know what I mean? So definitely had that happen, if that carpet would have rolled out beneath my feet, I definitely would have stepped upon it and would have either came with a new style or the Afro-Ra style. You know, when you was around such creativity like RZA, GZA, and even myself and where I was coming from, being around some of the dopest MCs of our time, True Master, Jay Rudah Damager, Guru. I was around Gangstar and DJ Premier, and also I was in the studio with Fat Joe and LL Cool J and the Beat Miners and Smith Wesson. And you know, we were all in that zone creatively. So had the Wu-Tang rolled the carpet out for me, for sure, I would have swung my sword in multiple directions for them. But they had their thing. I was with Jay Rudah Gangstar Foundation. It never even came up. But we was people. We were people. Yeah. And even as huge as RZA got, if I saw him tomorrow somewhere in an airport or somewhere, it would be like that time when we were would be brought right back to this day on a peace. What's up? Peace to the fam and everything. And you know, love is love. And I'm proud of RZA and GZA and Wu-Tang and all those brothers for just doing that. You know, for doing that.
Now, I was listening to all your albums recently, and I have to say, it felt like that you pick a lot of your beats, because I just feel like every beat is really hot. Is that typically what happens? You pick most of your beats?
Yeah, definitely. It just always happened like that. In the beginning, my hand was held, but I still was picking. I still was choosing. Like on my first album, I was with Primo, so you know, Primo's like, all right, I'm gonna give you most of the album. I also was with D&D Records, and because D&D Records, they were booking the studio time for the greats like Fat Joe and Evil D&B Miners and whoever was coming through D&D Studios. So it was like, okay, Primo gonna hold you down, I fool. And Primo gave me those initial bangers like Werewolf Through Cities, Defeat, Equality with Kimani Marley.
I love Equality. I love Equality.
And then I think he might have also given me like Monotony. And then what helped Primo was another producer, Joe Roach, who actually produced Whirlwind Through Cities, which was my first lead-off single, who actually came through the DJ Premier kind of, workmanship. And Primo heard the beat and was like, yo, that'll be perfect for Afu. That's how I got that beat. That was my lead-off single, and I think it kind of shaped my whole everything. So not that I picked every beat to outdo that Whirlwind Through Cities beat, but just the song that I created on that beat, and that was my first song that I wrote, Whirlwind Through Cities. So I started picking all my beats from the perspective of songs, what I did on Whirlwind, Defeat, and then yeah, I always picked all my beats and yeah, just from the, you know, the coagulation or the combination of the different producers, the aura or where I was at, and yeah, from some producer somewhere in Slovakia, somewhere deep Europe, somewhere, I always just try to just pick those beats that like they're gonna stand the test of time, or that I can write a dope song to it, or that I can put it up against my best tracks that I think I wrote, you know, Whirlwind and Defeat and all of those, and just let it flow. You know, sometimes you have a great song, which I can say I did some of those, and sometimes maybe I chose great beats, maybe I didn't write the best song on them, but it was still fun doing it, and I look forward to continuing to make music and that way find beats that I'm like, ooh, like, you know, get that feeling like, okay, like such a challenge and such a feel good moment that I can't wait to like put the pen to the track and get in the studio and lay the vocals.
Now you got a really good ear. I would trust you with picking like all the beats for my album.
Thank you very much. Not a lot of people have told me that. I don't know how it happened. Maybe I always wanted to kind of be slightly eclectic in my beat choice. I always wanted to have a sense of hip hop and but then once I did the reggae style on the first album, maybe that kind of opened me up, because in the first album I had the hip hop, and then I had somewhat of like a hip hop reggae thing. And once I went out on tour and I saw my hip hop reggae audience, the captivation I had there, I was like, okay, musically, I can be diverse as long as I keep my like cornerstone of the scientific, the influential, the Taoist entities in my flow. That's where I can go with reggae, and then I kind of went a little bit with rock, and maybe you might have noticed on my albums and beat selection, I guess a musical, like the musical taste is kind of spread out. You might hear some jazz or funk. That comes from Primo also. Primo never was shy about the type of records he samples from. So even P.F. Cutton, who I worked a lot with also later in my career, also who's from the original school. But for some reason, me and P.F. Cutton, once I got with Primo, our relationship had to like stop for a second. But once I got off of the Gangsta Foundation kind of, let's say, bandwagon, and I was kind of more independent, I started working more with P.F. Cutton. And those producers, as great as they are, when they are making their beats, you never know what beat they're going, you know, what record they're going to grab and sample from. It could be a salsa record. It could be a, I don't know, so African drums record. It could be jazz record. It could be like, so their sample tastes are like out the park. You never could guess. So when I choose my beats, I kind of try to have the same ear, but I'm always just looking for that beat to just grab me. That's like, yo, I fool, like, you got to rhyme on me. Like, and those are the kind of, that's how I guess I ended up with the tracks that you hear on the albums that I have.
Yeah, shouts out to P.F. Cutton. I did an interview with him like last year.
Yes, sir. Yeah, amazing dude. And he and I, as I got the joints with Primo, I got joints with P.F. Cutton too. And he's an amazing dude. And yeah, he always been there for me. And I love his work.
So you got a really dope song on the, I think it's the second album, with Big Daddy Kane. Is that one of the guys you always wanted to work with? And did his thing on there.
Yeah, Big Daddy Kane. You know, I came in the game, or let's say, if not for artists like Kane, I'm not going to say Kane, but yeah, maybe Kane. He was one of those first rappers that, you know, like I was just rhyming his lyrics all over the city, all over the house. I'm in that crib and I'm, you know, rapping Big Daddy Kane. He was definitely one of those first artists, I'm going to say, after Run DMC for me, where I wanted to mimic their style just in repeating their lyrics. Big Daddy Kane, Slick Rick, Dana Dane, maybe a little bit Bismarcky, Heavy D, maybe a little bit of X-Clan, Brother J. I would say, like, without me mimicking them and being like just so into their rap style, I guess that's how I kind of became an MC, like in my own right, or developed my own type of style. Of course, yes, being around J. Rule, because J. Rule was a beast. J. Rule was really like every day, yo, I fool, come to my crib, I wrote this new track. Come to my crib, y'all, I wrote this new rhyme. Oh, y'all, fool, I'm gonna meet you up the hill. I got this new joint. So he was coming with it, like, yo, fool, like, not to say, like, critique him, but just give him that thumbs up, or just to just hear him, you know what I mean? Just to hear him. We didn't have YouTube. We didn't have a Wii. And I was his younger brother. And for whatever reason, he gave me that respect that, yeah, he gonna unleash the wrath on me. And I was just there like, okay. And I don't think J. Rule wrote a whack song. Every song he wrote when we were kids were like, okay, like when he got his album deal, I was like, yo, what happened to this song and that song? And what happened to that, you know? And he was like, I forget what he said or whatever, but, you know, he had new beats. He had the new Primo wave and everything. So, but yeah, that Big Daddy Kane track, Kurt Cazell made the beat. Again, Kerry Cazell was signed to D&D Records. he was in the studio doing something, and somehow he just played that beat. Boom, 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 boom. And I was like, whoa, what beat is that? Like, what's that? And Kurt Cazell is kind of a modest guy. He's a genius also. Very modest. He just smiled. I was in the mix of my thing. I had this height of success with the Body of the Lifeless album. So when we were in D&D Studios or D&D Records, I kind of had my position. Dudes knew what was up. And I was like, yeah, on the new album, I want to do something with Big Daddy Kane. I kind of knew I did. I heard that beat. Kurt Cazell was like, of course. How could I say no to something to that effect? I didn't know Kane. I wish maybe I had have known him prior to maybe going into writing the track. I think maybe, as good as that song is, I think maybe we rushed it. I think maybe we rushed the song, and maybe we could have did something. I don't know. But when I hear that track, it's kind of like we playing around on the beat. As good as a beat it is, as good of a track as it is. As much as I love the song, it's a stick up. After I saw what Kane went on to do in his re-emergence into his own artistry, I feel maybe that we jumped the gun or we didn't take enough time to just nurture Kane, because he's the big brother. He's the senior. He's like the mentor. I didn't take the time to like get that from him. It was just like, I got my album, I got my thing. Yo, Kane, my label talked to him, blah, blah, blah. I don't think it came from the sincere place it should have came from me, although I didn't know that at the time. And as much as I love the fact that I have the song, that we did that, we did the video, he was such a cool dude. I don't know, for some reason, I think we could have done something more monolithic.
Okay.
I don't know why. Maybe it was that beat, but yeah, shout out to Kane. Always smooth, always insightful, always deep, always dope. And without him, I don't think maybe I would have like the MC, like MC and kind of like thirst to like get on the mic, whether I'm doing tracks or if I'm at my show and want to bring that wowness. Want to bring that wowness to when I'm on the mic, even if it's for 8 bars, you know what I mean? Give that, because that's what I got from artists like KRS-One and Coogee Rap and Big Daddy Kane. Of course, there are so many others, but I definitely got that from Kane, and I try to walk with a little piece of Big Daddy Kane when I jump on the stage or when I jump behind the mic in the studio.
So you released the compilation, Afro Rock Presents Perverted Monks. I remember J. Rue had the intro on the album Perverted Monks in the House.
Yes,
like,
sir.
Who came up with that? Who came up with the whole Perverted Monks? And is that an actual group?
Well, actually, I'm happy that you asked that. The Perverted Monks were kind of like one of those secret crews. It primarily was me and J. Rue.
Okay.
It was kind of like, you know, the monikers that you give yourself because you have funny moments. You have a connection to a certain small window in time. And that small window in time was from the Tai Chi master. Tai Chi master, one of Jet Li's first flicks that we saw of Jet Li, that we was like, whoa, Jet Li is like Jet Li. And there was like, it was like, I'm not sure if it's that movie. It's one movie either way. The Perverted Monks was just a group of bandits that were doing like hideous things. It's really not a good crew, actually, but we kind of took that name on the Perverted Monks. They were monks who were going out pillaging and raping. They were monks. So the ideology of a perverted monk, what is a perverted monk? As someone that's trying to do their thing, trying to stay on the square and be righteous. Yeah. However, those negative aspects of the life, how you may be out in the club, you may be like looking after certain things that maybe might not be so monkish, if you could follow where I'm going with. So perverted monks, it was kind of like a code word between me and J. Rue when J was making his album, when he was in the skit zone. I'm not even sure if he thought about it. It just came on that beat, and J. Rue had that synchronicity in him that he can just flow and concepts could just come out of him. And I'm really touched that I was able to tap into that, and I'm still tapped into it right now. No matter what happens, when the studio comes on and the beats start flowing and you in that zone, we tap into those creative zones that we technically never relinquished. We never relinquished the zone of creativity. I think artists like Pharrell and many artists spoke about, like, the creative consciousness is alive. And when it's your time to, like, use it, understand that, you know? So then it's just about what energy you channeling, okay? And once you channel the right energy, the creative zone is already there. You just basically tapping back into it to create what you can manifest at the moment. So
yeah,
I'm definitely so blessed that I was able to see J. Rue, like, radiating at the highest point of creativity as well. Guru, GDJ Premier, when they was in those zones of, didn't know what the hell they was going to do. They had a mission, and then they opened the door of creativity, and then boom, bam, bam, bing, it just flow. Myself and Master Killer, we did it together. Numerous times writing the songs for Mortal Kombat and living like that. Even the songs, yeah, me and J. Rue on the East New York Stamp when we wrote for RZA for the Ghost Dog soundtrack. So I'm really blessed.
I forgot about that. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm really blessed to have tapped into that zone of creativity and understand it and be able to use it whenever I want it. So the Perverted Monks, I was off of D&D Records. D&D and Koch had a separation. Koch didn't want to pick my let's say third album option up. I tried to go to them independently also. They wasn't with it. I'm not sure what was going on, but I think maybe they might have been tapping into the yin yang twins, and that's what they were doing at that moment. So my style, yin yang, it wasn't
it wasn't
like the same. And to be honest, I think Smurf was like one of yin yang's right hand men or one of their soldiers. And Smurf, he and I go back to high school also. So my synchronicity in the music industry and the artists that I've been around has always been like a connected thing of people that, I was connected with, somehow had our paths in life were coming from the same path. Even Smith & Wesson, Coco Beats, Steel was my homie Kenneth Montgomery's best homie when we were in high school before there was Smith & Wesson. And that's when Sean P and a bunch of dudes from East New York and Brooklyn was rolling around as the Decepticons.
And okay, Decepticons,
they was out in Manhattan. My high school was in Manhattan. And that's when I first met, you know, Steel for Smith & Wesson, you know, when that whole craziness was going around New York City, let's say street gangs with the Decepticons. You know, I had met, you know, Sean P and Sean P, Rock.
Yeah, Rockness.
Also, Steel, General Steel. So later on, when my album things just started just bubbling, brothers happened to be right at the studio, and they also a super group with Smith & Wesson and Buckshot and Black Moon. So it's amazing. It's amazing that at least I can definitely see, and I touched on and tapped into your understanding, your synchronicity. It's like how your origin has always been here. Just follow the best way you think you can manifest what should be manifested, and what becomes of it will become of that. But it's already kind of laid out in front of you, and I've been blessed And I could say that, yeah, my synchronicity, my energy, my flow has always been going in a direction. So after I split with D&D Records, it was like, okay, what am I do now? It was like my brothers was right there. My brother-in-law, which is Respect to God, the Cage Monk, my two younger cousins, the Aqua Monk and the Solar Monk. And then myself was like, yo, look, y'all dudes are so, we disfragmented. You guys is doing whatever. Perverted Monks is right there. We perverted monks. I'm Perverted Monk, you know? Like, boom. So put the album together. J.Ru was there. Because me and J.Ru was, like, tight like that, and we never formed an organized crew called the Perverted Monks. It was always our secret code word.
Yeah.
We didn't have to go to J.Ru like, yo, Ru, such and such.
Yeah, I'm gonna can I use Perverted Monks? Yeah.
It was already like he and I, if we wanted to say, were general monks in that, but we never formed the crew of it. Monk. And it was like my brothers and my younger cousin, J.Ru, know them from when my younger cousins was babies. So it would only be like the older monk. It would only be like the older brother either giving his stamp of approval, which he did basically, by not interfering with what we was doing. You know what I mean? So it was like, that's how the Perverted Monk album came about, because of that, the disfragmented, let's see, sense of artistry I saw my younger cousins in, also my brother-in-law. Yeah. I had the platform that I had. Also, what was I going to do with the Afro-Ra movement? I'm not going to say I was depressed. I was actually feeling great. And then it just came together. I think we went in the studio one day with a brother named G13. He just happened to be in the studio, had this crazy beat. It was the first one. Me, Jadon, and Aqua Monk voiced it. It was called Doing It. No. How we gonna do it, y'all? The place I don't know. Run out for do it now. Buckles day, but I know. And I've been cool. So that kind of like sparked the making of the Perverted Monks music. And from there, we brainstormed, okay, we're going to do it like this. We're going to go on tour. We're going to. And we did that. We had our success with that. We were able to go on tour, I think two tours around the States, around Europe. And not to say that the group fell apart, but, you know, the industry and making albums and being on the road with guys and continue to conceptualize and come back to the table again to do second projects. A lot has to go into that. A lot of foundation has to be up under people. And I don't think the Perverted Monks, we really had that. Maybe we were riding the hype of wanting to do it for the first time, but then afterward, the nucleus just wasn't there with the group to like want to continue doing that. Also, I had my Afro-Ra career to also look after. And then I kind of, after the Perverted Monks, I kind of got to Europe. And in Europe, I found a whole, like a completely different set of standards or artists, producers, ways to make music, ways to stay on tour, continue to stay afloat financially. And I kind of never resurfaced in the States since that time, which was around 2007. And I kind of saw a different side of the game where we're like in Europe, there's a certain standard that artists receive without being, let's say, on the top again, or let's say back on the top of the charts with the newest music, the certain kind of European standard of booking shows, to the hotels, to the way the business runs. Not to say that entities in the US don't have a certain standard, but it's a lot harder and it's much more grind mode in the States. I found, or maybe I just been in Europe so much that I didn't take the time to, let's say, nurture more avenues and pathways to just be in the States and be in the different states around the country, doing quality tours, doing quality events. is I would have to say that since I've been in Europe since 08, 09, I kind of never went back to America. Like, hey, America, I'm here, and I'm networking with dudes in Chicago or Virginia. And I kind of never did that in my career. And, you know, after the 20 years into the career, still in Europe, if I get back to the States doing things, it'll be like one-offs here and there. And I look forward to those times.
Well, even Jay Roo moved overseas, though, didn't he? To like Bulgaria or something?
That's right. Jay Roo did. Jay Roo actually, shout out to Jay Roo. Older brother, Jay Roo the Damager, I believe, was in Berlin, and I believe he might have bounced through Austria and Spain. Not sure where he's at the moment, but each time I did see him, he was doing well. He and I had reconnected and did many things, from doing concerts, doing tours, as well as doing music if it was in the studio for other DJs or other artists. So even ups and downs, Jay Roo and I went through, we still maintain a sense of brotherhood and respect. My hat always goes off to Jay Roo the Damager.
Now, can we expect any new music from you in the future?
Most definitely. Actually, as we speak about that, I recently, within the last year, started to kick off the release of the remake of my classic album, The Body of the Life Force. As I spoke to you about not having the ownership or the exclusive rights to The Body of the Life Force, so I'm in the process of remaking that complete album. So far, we have tracks like Show God Assassination, which is the remake of Soul Assassination, which is online right now. It's videos on YouTube, Show God Assassin. We also have the Terror Trilogy. Originally, Trilogy of Terror was myself, Hannibal Stacks, and Guru. Uh-huh. So Terror Trilogy is the remake, and it features Rockness Monster and the producer slash artist, Ruffian Rugged, Death Ill out of Linz, Austria. So those two remake singles songs are out right now, and we just released, I released another one called Test Me. It's kind of like a new exclusive that will be on the album. So I have been making new music. New music is out there. Of course, as you know, if you don't have the huge gangbuster promotion, it's very difficult that people just know what's up and what's happening with artists and the music they're releasing. So Afura, new music is out now, part of the project called The Reincarnation of the Body of the Life Force. So The Reincarnation of the Body of the Life Force is remaking the entire album with a similar sound, similar, let's say, aesthetic. Of course, I may not be able to accomplish it, but it is the attempt. So check out those songs, Show God Assassin, Terror Trilogy, featuring Rockness Monster, and Test Me. And I just released the new freestyle, let's say, excerpt of the album, The Body of the Life Force Freestyle. So definitely working on new music, and also have the idea, or also have my sights set on creating, I don't want to say a European album, but definitely I want to try and make like a global release as I'm in Europe, and I want to try to tie the loose ends together with my people in the Czech Republic, Slovakia, France, Germany, the United Kingdom, and kind of do a project that's like Euro-centered. And there's a lot of avenues in Europe. There's a lot of, let's say, those industries that are attached to the hip-hop market that can, let's say, be attractive for me as I'm getting older and I'm looking to do different things, plus make music. So doing a Eurocentric album, maybe might be called Afro Europe or something connected with Europe. And it's definitely going to be about hip-hop music, hip-hop, reggae, maybe electronic sounds or dance music. who knows, but definitely something working with the producers and artists from Europe, Middle Europe, Eastern Europe, and the United Kingdom, Germany, and France. So it's just an idea, it's a concept, but that's where I would like to go after the reincarnation of the body of the life force.
Two songs I really like that. I think some of your latest work, Lyrics Fly. Ooh. I was zoning out to that one.
Yeah, well, that one, yeah, and that one, Lyrics Fly. Yeah. Lyrics Fly with the Lord Coast City on it.
Yeah, the beat was just so amazing. Ooh, I mean, I was just zoning out. And then you got the groupie girl. I kind of like that. I like to see that you groupie were doing girl, something different.
But the groupie girl, it was on the Body of the Life Force Part 2. It just, again, it goes back to having an idea and then not really having the follow-up arsenal or plan or business idea to really, like, I don't want to say exploit a song like that, but yeah, exploit that and make it a vision and make it something that is more than a song. Not to say I wish I didn't do it, but it kind of fell on deaf ears and didn't have any kind of, like, it didn't have any push behind it. And maybe it was made out of a fun song, which didn't have any, like, didn't have any business sense behind it or nothing more than just a song, if you could say.
Yeah, but I thought it was a really good dance record for the clubs.
Yeah, definitely was. When I think about the song, I actually forget that we released it on the two album. Lyrics Fly was on. Yeah, it was released on the Body of the Life Force Part 2 album, and then we remade it again with Lord Coast City from France. And yeah, you are right. The beat is so melancholic and so, like, thought-provoking.
Something about it, man. Something about it.
Yeah, that's produced by a Digital Cut. They produced my last album, the Urban Chemistry album. So yeah, as you spoke about Body of the Life Force, Life Force Radio, The Perverted Monks, The Body of the Life Force Part 2. We also got the Urban Chemistry album.
Yeah, I didn't see that one.
Yeah, Urban Chemistry, and we also got The Master Chef.
Okay. They got to update your Wikipedia. They didn't have those on there.
Okay, no doubt. So still in the mix, still in the flow, still in the game. I'm happy that we tapped in. And by the way, how did the idea come about to have me on your program?
Well, you know, I'll be interviewing a lot of people from the 90s era, you know what I'm saying? So I like to go, as I say, digging in the crates for my interviews.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. I'm a big Gangstar Foundation guy, you know what I'm saying? Okay, I interviewed Guru before he passed when he was with Solar.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
Yeah, him and Solar were doing a show in Denver. Mm-hmm. And I was one of probably the last interviews he did, like, before he had passed and whatnot. Ooh. And I've always been a diehard Guru guy, man. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, Guru. Yeah, he was special. I remember as well, like, at the tail end of his career when he was doing the Solar thing, and I believe he was on maybe one of his it might have been a Jazzmatazz 2 tour mixed with what he was doing with Seven Solar. Grand Rising. Yeah, what he was doing with Solar, and he was somewhere in Europe. I think it might have been Berlin, and I ran into him at the concert, and it was all love, but I could see at that moment, I could see that he wasn't in his best physical condition. However, he did do his show. He did hold it down. Show was great. The house was packed. And then shortly after, the news came that he passed away. So RIP, Guru. And nothing but good things to say about him.
Yep. I got one more question before you go, though.
Yeah, sure.
What is the body of the life force?
Wonderful question. To my knowledge, the body of the life force, in the book, Afura is a story. In the book, Afura was a fisherman.
Okay.
Afura was just a normal person in the book where through an element or moment of turmoil in life, focused on himself, basically being calm, and the life, which was somewhat chaotic or terrifying, calm to a normal, pleasant day. Okay, that's the story of Afura. So the story of Afura is understanding himself, that the fortitude of being strong-willed and being poised as an individual, the best will come. That's Afura in the story. Mm-hmm. But in terms of Egyptology, Afu is the body and Ra is the life force. When you break the name down, so Ra, yes, the sun god, which gives life to everything on the planet or everything within its circumference. So, and Afu was the body or the embodiment. So Afura is the body of the life force, basically the embodiment of what creates life. So the body of the life force, that's why the first album was titled the way it was titled, to basically self-define, self-titled first album, Afura, the body of the life force. So Afu is the body, Ra is the life force, and you smash them together, the body of the life force.
That's crazy. Yeah, cause I'm a big Egyptian guy too. I mean, Egyptian culture is just so intriguing, interesting, and mysterious.
That's right.
Well, before I let you go, any shout outs you want to do, man?
Just shout out to the whole East Coast, shout out to the whole West Coast, all America, Denver, wherever you at, Chicago, New York. Of course, I'm from Brooklyn, New York. Yeah. And mainly talk to your listeners, keep it locked right here. Keep supporting this channel. Bringing people like myself here, giving me a chance to express myself. And I don't do a lot of interviews, so it was a pleasure. It was a pleasure being here, speaking with you. I hope I was able to go where you needed me to go for the listeners, also for yourself, to just open back that door up to the body of the life force and my career, what I'm doing, what I had done, also what I'm looking to do in the future. It's a pleasure. Stay safe. Keep doing what you're doing. Reach back out to me if you need anything.
Yeah, will do.
And I'm here, my brother. So stay safe.
Yeah, I appreciate you taking the time out, man. I mean, like I said, I like to dig into the crates for my interviews, and I feel like these stories, if they stop getting told,
yes, sir.
You know, people are going to forget about them. You know, like America's got this, you know, it's like this, what have you done for me lately mindset, you know, and overseas, I think that's why they appreciate, you know, real hip hop more, because it's not all about what have you done for me lately. They love, you know, old school and new school from what I'm seeing, you know.
So. Yeah. You're right about that. It's like it's as if sometimes when I go do my shows in the States, is as if I'm back then at that time, like I happened to perform the old songs, even though I never stopped performing like my original classic songs. I always look forward to performing them, but I get that feeling from the people who in the crowd, like, man, like, either they big me up for making those songs, or they're still in that zone of where we were when we first recorded the song. And it's a wonderful feeling. And not to throw any shade on anyone, but I definitely get that feeling a lot from the U.S. and from Europe.
Yeah.
Not to say that, like, I never feel like I need to make new music.
Yeah.
But I almost feel as if, like, hey, those classic bombs that I got with the greats, like with the Master Killer and Primo Madem and the first album stuff and some of the second album stuff, it's kind of like I'm good. Like, let me just do better relationships with people and get out there and continue to be happy being an artist and performing and smashing the mic. And it's like I never get a feeling like I didn't give my audience something because of those classic gems. And I'm extremely blessed. I'm super psyched that I could even say that. And it's an honor to share that with you also. And I'll catch you next time. Let me know if you want me to come back live on the air. We do it again, all right?
I appreciate it, man. It's an honor having you on, man. And enjoy the rest of your day, man.
Okay, spectacular. One love. Okay, next time.
Peace.
Peace.
Well, there you have it. A little late, but I mean, still interesting interview, man. I mean, a lot of names being dropped in there. J-Rue, Guru, Premier. Didn't know that he was close with Hannibal Stacks as well. Hannibal Stacks is pretty much part of Gangstar. Had a really good career. I think his album is one of the most underrated albums. Never understood really what Body of the Life Force meant, and now I know. And there was two other albums that he said we got to go check out as well. And I'm going to definitely hit him up, see if he got any new music for the music reviews that we do on Saturdays. But yeah, y'all go check out Afu Ra. Go follow Afu Ra. Go back, listen to Body of the Life Force, Life Force Radio, State of the Arts, Body of the Life Force 2. And he said he got new music on the way as well. So that's going to be interesting. And I mean, he's worked with a lot of people through the years. You know, you had the album, the first album. I mean, you literally had production for Premier, DJ Muggs, True Master, the Beat Miners. Guests included Wu-Tang's, GZA, Master Killer, MOP, Kaimani Marley, and the Coco Brothers, who had changed their names from Smith & Wesson to the Coco Brothers at that time, but now changed it back to Smith & Wesson. Then he dropped his second album, Life Force Radio. That was on May 2002. That was on Kosh as well. He had Premier, True Master, Easy Mo B, Domingo, and Ayatollah on productions. I ain't heard that name in a while, Ayatollah. And I need to actually hit up some of these producers as well. I've been actually just hitting up a lot of rappers lately. I need to go hit up cats like Domingo and Ayatollah and see what's going on. Guests include Guru, rest in peace to Guru. I actually interviewed him before he passed away some years ago. Big Daddy Kane, RZA, Tina Marie was on that album as well, man. And he's literally had a Wu-Tang artist on every album. At least the first three that I know of. But yeah, shout out to Afu Ra for coming in live all the way from the Czech Republic. And I was wondering why, you know, he moved out there. And it makes all the sense in the world if you're a guy from that era that makes that kind of hip hop. Most of your shows are overseas. So it makes sense to almost find a country that's overseas that you could move to and for your likings and whatnot. And that way you're closer overseas for when they do the shows. They don't got to worry about flying you across the ocean. Or if you're KRS-One, you don't fly. You take a boat across the ocean. That's why when you book KRS-One overseas, you got to catch him while he's still overseas. Because as soon as he gets back across the water, man, across the pond, he probably just on the U.S. tour. And then when he does the European tour, it's probably all at the same time. But you got J-Rue lives overseas as well. A lot of cats moved overseas. I know Russell Simmons moved overseas, not for the same reasons. Some of the Outlaws, I think, moved overseas, like to Africa or something like that. But it makes a lot of sense if you most of your shows in Europe to go ahead and be over there. Because, you know, Germany, France, Japan, I mean, even Russia's still popping. In the middle of war, if I'm not mistaken, freaking Onyx still goes and does shows in Russia while they're at war. You know? But, yeah, shouts out to Afu Ra, man. Make sure y'all go check out his music. I checked out all his albums. And I have to say, he's got a really good ear for production, really good ear for picking beats. And like I said, he could definitely pick all the beats for my album, and I would definitely trust his judgment on that. Well, appreciate everybody tuning in. I had to go live early. I'll probably restream this again later at like 7 p.m. Eastern time and whatnot. But he was 6 hours ahead, so I had to go in early. And even though he was a little bit late, I appreciate him taking the time out to doing the interview in the first place. Once again, thank you for tuning in. stream live on Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube. Audio version to be downloaded, and that'll be uploaded to Spotify, Apple, Amazon, Deezer, TuneIn, Stitcher, Slacker, iHeartRadio, also on Rumble as well. Once again, thank y'all for tuning in to another episode and another interview. And I'm the one and only Paul Masson, and this is live from Vietnam. Peace. I'm out.